Well, I would encourage you to open up your Bibles to 2 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 22. 2 Chronicles chapter 22. We're going to be looking at chapters 22 and 23. We are moving through a particularly dark period of Judah's history. And yet, one of the things that we will find as we move through this, that in the darkness there will be a great light. And that light is the faithfulness of God. And we will see that again and again and again in this book. I never tire of telling people that the Christian gospel is, first of all, an indicative, and then it is an imperative. In other words, there is a thing called gospel grammar. Gospel grammar, which is why, children, you should learn grammar and you should enjoy grammar, because grammar teaches you about the gospel. And that is that the gospel is an indicative before it is an imperative. What is an indicative? An indicative is a statement of fact. It is a statement of fact about who God is and what God has done for us. Now, there are gospel commands. There are commands, which is what an imperative is. There are gospel commands. But before those gospel commands ever come, there's first the indicative. And the indicative of the gospel is Jesus Christ, the second person of the triune Godhead, became flesh. He was born of the Virgin Mary. He lived in perfect submission and obedience to God's law. He died on the cross for sinners, rose again the third day, conquering hell and death, and he ascended to the right hand of the Father, where he now intercedes for us. Those are the gospel facts. And so the Christian life begins with God and what he has done, not with me and what I have to do. That's huge for us to understand. That is the nature of Christianity. That before I ever do anything, it is predicated on what God has done. He gives us promises. He makes provisions. And so trusting in those promises, trusting in those provisions, we respond in faith and obedience to God's command. So there is a response on our part. There is an indicative that we must follow, an imperative that we must follow, but it is predicated on God's promises. I want you to think about how that might change the way we live our lives when we think about the promises of God and how those promises of God are absolutely unwavering and will absolutely be kept. And what I mean by that is that we think about the truth of the gospel, not just like in a stated affirmation of a creed like we just read, but an actual inner conviction and an inner assurance that what God has done for us through Christ is absolutely true, and we can base our lives on it. How might it change our lives when we think about it in that way? What if we believe the promises of God like we believe the calendar? I mean, we have very little doubt, and in fact, I would suggest probably no doubt, that when we wake up tomorrow morning, it will be Monday, March the 6th. No doubt about that. And not only do we absolutely know and are assured and have a conviction that tomorrow will come, and it will be Monday, and it will be March the 6th, so we order our lives around that. We get up and we go to work. We do the things that we would normally do on Monday. We know that our anniversaries are coming up. We have certain important dates coming up. And we order our lives around those dates and around the things that those dates are to signify. What if we did the same thing with the promises of God? What if we were so assured of the truthfulness of those gospel indicatives, that we would seek to order our entire lives around them. How would it change our rush for significance, our insatiable desire for prestige? How might it change if we truly believe the promise of God when He said, "Blessed are the meek, for they are the ones who will inherit the earth"? How would it change us? How would it change our fight against lust if we really believed Matthew 5:8, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God"? Those are promises. And they are promises that are true. And if we truly believe them, we order our lives accordingly. How would it change how we respond to suffering if we truly believe 2 Corinthians 4:17, where Paul says, "For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison"? How would believing in the promises of God change the way we live? Do I trust in God's word? Do I trust in His promises? Because you see, the root of sin is really unbelief. From the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, the question was posed and the doubt was raised. Did God really say? Did God really say? And you see, that is really the beginning of every sin. Whether you realize you're asking that question or not, the moment of temptation, you're asking the question, "Did God really say?" And if you don't believe it, then you will sin. If you don't, or if you really believe it, you won't sin. And if you do believe it, wait, did I get that mixed up? If you believe it, you won't sin. If you don't believe it, you will. Okay, there you go. But we have to ask that question. Do we really take God at His word? Do I really believe what He has said? You see, when we sin, we are saying, in effect, "I don't believe that God said that. I don't believe He said that. I don't believe He meant that. I think that I can trust myself in this situation. I think I know better how to run my own life. I trust myself more than I trust God." You see, beloved, that is the reason why sin is so serious. Not because you broke some rules, but because sin at its very foundation is unbelief in what God has said, and it's a trusting in myself. That's what makes sin so serious. So as we prepare to look at 2 Chronicles 22 and 23, we have to remember that this book was written to exiles after the Babylonian exiles. They were returning from Babylon. And they were the ones that first received these chronicles. And these were exiles that were struggling to believe God's promises, just like we struggle to believe God's promises. And so they needed a reminder of how faithful God is. We need a reminder of how faithful God is. And so I want to take a look at 2 Chronicles 22. I've entitled the message, "Adaliah the Treacherous and God the Faithful." Adaliah the Treacherous and God the Faithful. And in fact, that is the outline of our text this morning. So I want to look, first of all, at Adaliah's treachery. Adaliah's treachery. I want to remind you of what we saw last week. Remember last week we were looking at chapter 21. We found that Judah was in very bad shape. All the good that Asa and Jehoshaphat had done was undone by Jehoram, who was the son of Jehoshaphat. And then comes Ahaziah, his youngest son. And this is a situation in which the apple does not fall far from the tree. If Jehoram was bad Ahaziah was horrible, and he was much worse than even his father was. I want you to look at verse 1. In verse 1 of chapter 22, it says, "And the inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, his youngest son, that is Jehoram's youngest son, king in his place." Now you remember how Jehoram died, right? Jehoram died. We find that in chapter 21, in verses 18 and following. We find that the Lord struck him with an incurable disease because of his sin, because he led Judah into idolatry, and he himself was involved in idolatry, and so the Lord struck him with a disease. And through the course of 2 years, he struggled with that disease. That was the judgment of God against him. And he struggled with it until it finally took his life. And when it took his life, no one even mourned for him. He was not given a royal burial. He was not given a royal funeral. He was simply buried. He was just buried. And no one regretted it. No one regretted it. And so here we are. Jehoram is dead. And now his youngest son takes the throne. And it says that his youngest son was king in his place. Notice verse 1. "For the band of men that came with the Arabians," we saw that last week, "to the camp had killed all the older sons." And so Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, reigned. And Ahaziah was 22 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Adaliah, the granddaughter of Omri. Now, as we'll see in a moment, that's a very important point there, that she is the granddaughter of Omri, and her father was Ahab. Now, these are two people, Omri and Ahab constitute the pinnacle of wickedness in the northern kingdom. Okay, they are the pinnacle of wickedness. And from that pinnacle of wickedness comes the wife of Jehoram. And she gives birth to this Ahaz. So this is how wicked things had become. This is how bad things had become. And so Ahaziah reigns, but he only reigns for 1 year. But in that 1 year, he manages to get it really, really, really wrong. Like I said last week, a bad leader can do a lot of bad in a very, very short time, but a good leader takes much, much longer to do good. Well, here's a man who is a bad leader, and he did a lot of bad in a very, very short amount of time. And not only was Ahaziah a bad leader, but he was a leader that was easily led astray. If you notice there in verse 3 it says, "He also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor in doing wickedly." Now, I'm glad that this is not Mother's Day, because I have to tell you that there are some really, really bad moms and grandmas in this story. Some really, really bad ones. But I want you to notice verse 4. In verse 4, it says, "Because of this wickedness that he was being counseled to do from his mother," verse 4 says, "he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as the house of Ahab had done. For after the death of his father, they were his counselors to his undoing. He even followed their counsel and went with Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, to make war against Hazael, the king of Syria at Ramoth-Gilead. And the Syrians wounded Joram." Now, let me just stop right there, because there's a change there in name. Jehoram and Joram is the same. Okay, matter of fact, in some of your translations, they actually have Joram repeated twice. So it's the same name. Okay, so you could just say that Jehoram, the Syrians wounded Jehoram. Now you might say, well, wait, I thought Jehoram was the father of Ahaziah, and here it says that he's the son of Ahab. It's a different man, completely different person. Same name, but a different person. And this shows us just how entangled things had become with the northern kingdom. I mean, they were naming, Jehoram was named, this Jehoram, the son of Ahab, was named because he was in the same line. They had actually crossed the lines here, Ahab's line with David's line. And that's the reason why there's this repeat of names. But Jehoram, the son of Ahab, verse 5, went to war against Hazael, the king of Syria, in Ramoth-Gilead, and the Syrians wounded Joram. And he returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds that he had received at Ramah when he fought against Hazael, king of Syria. Now, the worst leaders are not always those who actively seek out evil. You know, many times the worst leaders are passive and easily swayed. I mean, think about how much evil is brought into the world by someone who lacks conviction. Someone who has no principles. A person who is a people pleaser. Whatever the majority of people want, that's what he's going to institute. Think of the amount of evil coming into the world by people like that. People who lack convictions. People who have spines like jellyfish. I mean, these are people who are too timid and passive to actually seek out evil. I mean, they're too timid and passive to even do that. They don't stand up to people. And so, in effect, what happens is they become instruments that other people use for evil and wickedness, like Ahaziah. And things have gotten so bad that Jehu, the prophet, was anointed by God in verse 7 to destroy the house of Ahab. And not only to destroy the house of Ahab because of its wickedness, but to execute judgment on Judah as well. And we see that in verse 8. In verse 8 it says, when Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab, now get this, he has been anointed by God to destroy the house of Ahab. I mean, this is significant that he is tasked with going in and wiping out the house of Ahab. So he's executing, verse 8, judgment on the house of Ahab. He met the princes of Judah. Okay, so he's already going after the northern kingdom. Now he's going to go after the southern kingdom. And this has all been anointed by God. God has commissioned him to do this very thing. And so he met the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's brothers who attended Ahaziah, and he killed them. He searched for Ahaziah, and he was captured while hiding in Samaria, and he was brought to Jehu and put to death. And they buried him, for they said, he is the grandson of Jehoshaphat, who sought the Lord with all of his heart. It says, in the house of Ahaziah, had no one able to rule the kingdom. Now that's catastrophic. Things are very, very bad in Judah. Here their king is killed, and there is no one that is able to rule. Things are very bad, and they're going to get a whole lot worse before they get better. And so enter Adaliah. Adaliah, the anti-mom. Okay. The anti-mom. In verse 10, we see what she's up to. In verse 10, it says, now when Adaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose, and get this, and she destroyed all the royal family of the house of Judah. I mean, here's a woman who goes out and she is going to make sure that the entire royal line has been exterminated. Now, there's a special kind of wickedness that would make a woman do something like that. This is the hand of Satan himself going out to wipe out the Messiah seed before it can ever give birth to Jesus. And it's starting right here. Well, it's been starting even before this. But this is certainly one. So she destroys all the royal family of the house of Judah. But notice, verse 11, Jehoshabet. Okay, she's the good mom. So Adaliah, she's the anti-mom. Jehoshabet, she's the good mom. And notice, she is the daughter of the king. And she took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the king's sons who were about to be put to death. And she put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Now stop right there. This boy is less than a year old, so he's an infant. He's just an infant. And Adaliah, she would have killed him if she knew that he was there. And here is Jehoshabeth. She takes this little boy and she steals him away and she hides him. Thus, Jehoshabeth, the daughter of King Jehoram, and the wife of Jehoiada the priest, because she was sister to Ahaziah, hid him from Adaliah so that she did not put him to death. And he remained with them for 6 years, hidden in the house of God, while Adaliah reigned over the land. Now, there's a lot going on there, and it's kind of easy to kind of lose track of what's happening, but I'll make it as simple as I can. Adaliah, who is the mother of Ahaziah, who was just killed by Jehu, she sought to seize the throne of Judah for herself. And the only way she could actually pull that off and make it stick is by killing all of her grandsons. Bad grandma, right? Really bad grandma. Killed all of her grandsons. And the only son, which was not her son, was Joash. Now, Joash, his mom, was Zibiah of Beersheba. So we find that out in chapter 24 in verse 1. So Adaliah was not directly related to him. But here she's trying to wipe out all of these sons, and there's one that gets away, and he is Joash. And he's hidden away by Jehoshabeth, who is the daughter of Adaliah. So she hides him away so that Adaliah couldn't find him and kill him. Now, I want you to think about it this way. If Jehoshabeth had not hidden Joash away, it is likely that the entire Davidic line would have been wiped out. I think most people are in agreement that Joash was the last one. He was the only Davidic son that was left. Because back in chapter 21, verse 4, Jehoram killed all of his brothers. Remember that? He wanted to make sure that all of his brothers, who were way better than he was, he wanted to make sure that they were all gone. None of them would challenge him for the throne, and so he killed all of them. And then in chapter 22, verse 1, it says that all of Ahaziah's older brothers were killed. And then in chapter 22, verse 8, which we've already read, said that when Jehu met the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's brothers, he killed them. And so four times in a couple of generations, David's line was being wiped out. And there is only one left, and that is a little boy named Joash, still an infant. And there we see a glimpse of God's faithfulness. We start to see the first glimpse of God's faithfulness. That in spite of Adaliah's treachery, in seeking to wipe out the Messiah seed, to wipe out the sons of David, God's promises are still in effect. Is that an encouragement to you? That no matter how dark things become, no matter how grim things become, no matter how much the promises of God seem to have been nullified, God is faithful, always faithful to His promises. And we see that in chapter 23. So let's take a look at God's faithfulness. We've seen Adaliah's treachery. Now look at God's faithfulness. In chapter 23, it says, "But in the seventh year, Jehoiada took courage." I love that. He took courage. He was brave. Who is Jehoiada? He's the priest, right? He's the priest. And so he took courage and he entered into a covenant with the commanders of hundreds. Who are they? That's the military establishment of Israel. So So he makes a covenant with these military leaders. Okay, we all understand that if you make a covenant with the military leaders, you'll pretty much get what you want, right? In verse 2 it says, "And they went through Judah and gathered the Levites from all the cities of Judah and the heads of fathers' houses of Israel, and they came to Jerusalem." Verse 3, "And all the assembly made a covenant with the king in the house of God." Now this probably wasn't all that hard to make a covenant with these military leaders and these religious leaders, because Adaliah was probably not very popular. She had a reign of terror, and she was a horrible person. So even the pagans probably disliked her, and so this was probably not a very difficult covenant to pull off on the part of Jehoiada. But in verse 3. We see that the reason for this covenant is that they are going to crown the rightful king. And this king is presented in verse 3. And for all we know, this is probably the first time that any of them had seen this boy. Many of them probably didn't even know that he was alive. You know, his existence was kept secret by Jehoshabet. And so here they're going to crown this little boy as king. I don't know how this all took place. Perhaps Jehoiada went out to these commanders of hundreds and to the Levites, and he says, "Hey guys, listen, I know you think that the royal family's been wiped out, but there's one little boy left. There's one little boy left, and that is Joash." And so there's an excitement that starts to rise, that the line has not been wiped out, that God is faithful, and that there is one left. And it's this little 7-year-old boy named Joash. And so they make this covenant. And chapter 24, verse 1 says that because Joash was 7 years old, then he would have been crowned as a 7-year-old boy. And for those of you who have seen coronations, you'll know that coronations are really impressive when there's an impressive king or queen receiving the crown. This boy was not impressive. He was a 7-year-old. And you can almost imagine this little boy standing there in the midst of Jehoiada and these other priests, and he was probably hiding behind someone's leg, you know, shy, and but here he was. So he was very unimpressive, but what was most impressive was that he was a son of David. He was the last son of David. So let's keep reading in verse 3. "And Jehoiada said to them, 'Behold, the king's son, let him reign as the Lord spoke concerning the sons of David.'" So notice the priest here, he's citing the covenant that God made with David. That is the Davidic covenant, the promise that there would always be a son of David on the throne. So he's citing that. And in verse 4, he sets up the plan. And I have to tell you, as I'm reading through this, this is really exciting. I feel like I'm watching a movie or something. There's a lot of intrigue, and there's a lot of cloak and dagger going on. But notice what it says, verse 4. So Jehoiada, he's making the plan. And this is the plan. He says, "This is the thing you shall do. Of you priests and Levites who come off duty on the Sabbath, one third shall be gatekeepers, and one third shall be at the king's house, and one third at the gate of the foundation. And all the people shall be in the courts of the house of the Lord. Let no one enter the house of the Lord except the priests and the ministering Levites. They may enter, for they are holy, but all the people shall keep charge of the Lord. The Levites shall surround the king, each with his weapons in his hands, and whoever enters the house shall be put to death. Be with the king when he comes in and when he goes out." And so you see the plan is being hatched. And again, it's very exciting. You see all these guys, they're all together. They've got their weapons, and they're all ready. And they've got little Joash there. And he says, "Do not let Joash out of your sight. And if anyone comes in, you take him out." This is a coup. This is actually a righteous coup that's taking place. And this whole plan hinges on surprise. And they had two things going for them. First, they planned all of this to take place on the Sabbath during the changing of the guards and the changing of the Levites. You say, well, why is that important? Well, it's important because there's going to be a lot of people there. And so you have the outgoing guard and the incoming guard, and now you got double. You got double everything. And that was important because they need all of them. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know how Adonai is going to respond to this. They need to make sure they have all their best men armed and ready for combat. A lot of commotion would have been taking place during that time anyway, because it's the changing of the guards. And nobody would have thought that anything was out of the ordinary when they saw all these people and they were all armed. Nobody would have thought about it because that's what they do when they change the guard. The second thing they had going for them is that Adaliah was a pagan and she never went to the temple anyway. So she never would have even thought about it. She would have never seen it taking place. In fact, she was a worshiper of Baal or some other pagan deity. And so all this activity is taking place and going on in the temple. You have double the soldiers, double the Levites, and everyone is armed. And then look at verse 8. In verse 8 it says that the Levites and all Judah did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. And they each brought his men who were to go off duty on the Sabbath with those who were to come on duty on the Sabbath. For Jehoiada the priest did not dismiss the divisions. And Jehoiada the priest gave to the captains the spears and the large and small shields that had been King David's, which were in the house of God. And he set all the people as guard for the king, every man with his weapon in his hand, from the south side of the house to the north side of the house, around the altar and the house. And then they brought out the king's son, and they put a crown on him and gave him the testimony, and they proclaimed him king. And Jehoiada and his sons anointed him, and they said, "Long live the king." Now that's just exciting. They put the crown on this little boy's head, and they say, "Long live the king." And here's this little 7-year-old boy surrounded by the military and religious establishment of Judah. But they are crowning a Davidic king. And it was glorious and it was great. This is a defiant move. This is a coup, but it's a godly and righteous one. Because what they are doing is they are reasserting God's covenant with his people and reestablishing not only proper temple worship, but also King David. And keep in mind, this wasn't about a man. Because remember, Joash, he's 7 years old. So it's not like he was a physically attractive military champion, some powerful leader that all the guys just said, I want to get behind him. He was a 7-year-old. There was nothing intimidating about him at all. So it wasn't about him. But what it was about was God's plan and purpose, that he would always have a son of David on David's throne. That's what these people were getting behind. They weren't necessarily getting behind Joash per se, but they were getting behind the faithful promises of God. Well, Adaliah hears verse 12, because again, a lot of commotion, and all of a sudden you're hearing, "Long live the king, long live the king, long live the king," and she's saying, "Wait a minute, I'm the queen. You should be saying, 'Long live the queen,' not the king," so she knows something's up. Verse 12, when Adaliah heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she went into the house of the Lord to the people. And when she looked, there was the king, little guy, there was the king standing by his pillar at the entrance, and the captains and the trumpeters beside the king, and all the people of the land rejoicing and blowing trumpets, and the singers with their musical instruments leading in celebration. And Adaliah tore her clothes and cried, "Treason, treason!" Then Jehoiada the priest brought out the captains who were set over the army, saying to them, "Bring her out between the ranks, and anyone who follows her is to be put to death with the sword." For the priest said, "Do not put her to death in the house of the Lord." Notice how careful they are in not defiling the house of the Lord. This is significant. This has been a long time of idolatry and wickedness in Israel, and here is this great sense of reverence for the temple of God. Do not put her to death in the house of the Lord. Verse 15, so they laid hands on her, and she went into the entrance of the horse gate of the king's house, and they put her to death there. I mean, think of the shock that Adaliah felt. All these people in the temple, and trumpets are going off, and everybody's playing their instruments. And she starts hearing, "Long live the king! Long live the king! Long live the king!" And she's thinking to herself, "Wait a minute, I thought I killed all those little guys. I thought I wiped them out. But not Joash. Not Joash." You see, Satan has his people, namely Adaliah. But God has his. That other mom, Jehoshabet. And she was the one making sure that the Messiah seed . So Adaliah cries out, "Treason!" And yet, who's the true traitor? She's the traitor. And so Jehoiada puts her to death. In verse 16, it says, "And Jehoiada made a covenant between himself and all the people and the king that they should be the Lord's people. And then all the people went to the house of Baal and tore it down." Notice this. All these high places and altars and that Jehoram and then his son put up, all of these high places that they erected, they went out and they destroyed them. They tore them down, his altars and his images, they broke in pieces, and they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. And Jehoiada posted watchmen for the house of the Lord under the direction of the Levitical priests and the Levites whom David had organized to be in charge of the house of the Lord, to burn burnt offerings to the Lord, as it is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and with singing according to the order of David. And he stationed the gatekeepers at the gates of the house of the Lord so that no one should enter who was in any way unclean. Verse 20, and he took the captains, the nobles, the governors of the people, and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord, marching through the upper gate to the king's house. And they set the king on the royal throne. And so all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet because Adaliah had been put to death with the sword. The chronicler is making this very clear that this act of defiance, this coup, was the right thing to do. And for the first time in a long time, Judah has rest. And this victory is not just for King Joash. This is God's covenant being renewed with his people. This is God reestablishing his promises with his people. And this is seen in two ways. First, and I've already hinted at this a little bit, the Davidic worship was being reinstituted according to God's law. In other words, the temple was being placed back at the center of Israelite worship or Judah's worship. They removed Baal, they removed the high places, they removed all of those counterfeits, and instead replaced it with the rightful temple, with the rightful God. And so they did that. And not only did they reestablish temple worship, but there's all this emphasis on doing everything exactly the way it's supposed to be done, according to the law of Moses, according to the rule of David, the rule of David, all of that. So there's this emphasis placed on Davidic worship. And so that's one way that we can see that God's covenant was reestablished with his people. The second way that we see this is the establishment or the reestablishment of the Davidic dynasty. So Joash is being crowned as the king. And so for 6 years, we have seen an interruption in the dynasty, and now it's being restored. And remember, that was really that's the big theme that you find throughout Chronicles, right? Chronicles, you have two themes, the temple and David. The temple and David, that's really the two big things, the temple and David. And here you see the temple reestablished as the place of rightful worship, and then the Davidic dynasty reestablished as the rightful king. And so we've come full circle with God's promises. So we come back where we started. And that is that the Christian life is lived by faith in God's promises. And that's really important because many times our lives can look a lot like what's going on there in Judah. Things can look very, very dark. And the promises of God can seem like a distant memory. I mean, think about the 6 years that Adaliah reigned. She almost succeeded in wiping out the Davidic line. And she reigned as a wicked queen. And I'm sure people were saying, God, what's going on here? What about your promises? You said that we would always have a Davidic king on the throne, and yet we've got this woman who is the granddaughter of Omri, the daughter of Ahab, and she's sitting on the throne. What happened to the promises of God? So that was a big thing. But here's the thing that I was wondering about as I was putting this together. I wondered if we would have noticed what the Israelites noticed. What I mean by that is, one of the obvious lessons in all of this is trust God and His promises. But another lesson that we might miss is, are we living our lives in such a way that if the promises of God failed, would we even notice? Would we even notice? That's possible, especially if we're living according to the promises of the world. When we live for the world, when we live for the world's promises and for the world's provisions, then that's what's important to us. And so if the promises of God failed, we wouldn't even notice it. It wouldn't matter. Hey, did you hear that Adaliah wiped out the royal family? Oh, wow, bummer. Oh, well, you can get back to work. See you later. You see, in that scenario, they weren't trusting in the promises of God. They were trusting in themselves. They were trusting in whatever it was that they were drawing from the world. So I ask the question, if the promises of God seem to be failing, would we even notice it as the people of God? I hope we would. Because if we do not have the promises of God, if God does not keep His promises, if we can't trust in His promises, then we have to say, with Paul, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, we are of all people most to be pitied. In other words, if God will not keep His promises, let's throw in the towel and let's forget the whole thing. But you see, we have to have the kind of faith that's not mere sentimentality, but a faith that says, if God is not in this, it's going to fail. We have to be the kind of church that says, okay, we're gonna do VBS. And if God is not in this, it will fail. Let us not be a church that can just make it happen, even without God. A lot of churches are able to do that. They got money, they got resources. It's very easy to make something happen. But let us be the kind of church that says, if God is not in this, it will fail. Regardless of how much money we have, regardless of the resources we have, regardless of the talent that we're able to bring to the table, if God is not in this, then it will fail. And let us be the kind of church that says, and when God is in this, we will do anything. We will attempt great things for Him. You remember Abraham and Isaac? God tells Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. who is the son of the promise. And Abraham obeyed God. Why? Because he believed that if he killed his son Isaac, God would raise him from the dead. That's how convinced Abraham was of God's promises. And so he could obey. He could raise that knife and he could thrust it into his son because he believed that God keeps his promises. If I kill this boy, God will just raise him from the dead. I can imagine that Abraham struggled. You know, I imagine he said to God many times, God, you said that my descendants were going to be as numerous as the seashore, as numerous as the stars in the sky. But God, I'm 100 years old, and I only got one kid. And you want me to kill him? Do your promises mean anything? And Abraham demonstrated that God's promises meant everything, which is why he took his son up the mountain. And because of Abraham's faithfulness, because he believed the promises of God, he obeyed God, and God provided a substitute, the ram. And so Adonijah is ruling instead of a Davidic king. But God is faithful to his promise that the throne of David would not lack a son sitting on it. God moved Adonijah's own daughter to hide Joash, the only son left of David's line. And therein we see the faithfulness of God. And remember, Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of David's line, right? He is the ultimate fulfillment of that. If Joash had been killed, the Messiah seed would have been cut off. I mean, this is huge. This one event where Joash is hidden away. If something happened to that little boy, the Messiah seed would be cut off. No Christmas. Sorry, folks. Sorry, kids. No Christmas this year. No Christ and no salvation. But God is faithful to his promises, and the line of David was preserved. Let me tell you, Satan has been seeking to wipe out God's promises from the very beginning. Every time God defeats him. Are you having a tough time trusting God? Trusting in his promises? Hello? Right here. The faithfulness of God is demonstrated. Adonijah tried to wipe out all the sons to protect her own power. She was a tyrant. And there was another tyrant named Herod who wanted to protect his power, and so he went to destroy the newborn Jesus to protect his own power. And again, God intervened. A woman hid him away in Egypt until he would be revealed later as the king of Israel. Beloved, God always keeps his promises. You can trust in him. Fight against sin. Are you in a death struggle with sin? Sin seems to be winning way more than you are. Trust in the promises of God. Trust him. Because he always keeps his promises. Let's pray. Our Father, as we close our time in your word, I thank you so much for these wonderful stories. They're historical facts that tell us and are a record of your faithfulness to your people. From the very beginning, when sin entered the world, you made a promise that you would save us. And Father, you have been unfolding that promise ever since. And Father, we see these events that took place that showed that Satan was working overtime, trying desperately to destroy the seed before he was able to come, trying to destroy the one who would crush his head. And Father, you showed your power and your faithfulness again and again and again. In a very real sense, in a purely horizontal sense, this wonderful rescue of Joash is the reason why we are here today as followers of Jesus. I pray, Father, that we would remember even the small things, these small records of your faithfulness to your people, and that it would encourage us to always live obedient lives before you. Father, I pray that if there's anyone here this morning that's never put their faith and trust in Jesus Christ, that today would be the day that you would give them eyes to see, ears to hear, that they would see that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world, that they would stop trusting the promises of the world and start trusting the promises of God. We pray this in Jesus' name.